The CEO of Parliament will come at some stage. Parliament can't get its act together 21 years later. But we agree that we will continue the finance and tax regulation. Probably apologies from the Senate mentioned thinking of Congress. She's actually
not well.
So we will convey our wishes to her. Right. And then we'll go. Mr. Wong, UDM, he won't be here, obviously. Who else from the end? And Colin Com was not here. From the end, but if I think he's not here. Sikile. Okay, Sikile, the Mashon. Two apologies. Okay, having said that, the ANC component will just stay at 1 o'clock more. As soon as the meeting ends, we can discuss some in-house matters. Okay, over to you, Mom. Before we go on, may I just say one last thing. Ben Wicker will not be here tomorrow. He has a family matter, and you know, he can't be here tomorrow. So the other thing to mention is that the Public Enterprises Committee has said to us that they won't be able to meet us at 10. They will meet us at 10:30. Because they have got something else on from 9:30 to 10:30, which is simply not doing that right. So we took Peter's road, we started at 10:30. I was going to make it back at 10 to look at the program, but given that Alan won't be available, I think we'll just postpone the program to consider the program for next Tuesday. But in the meanwhile, I'll do a talk with Alan. Between Alan and I, we'll finalize the draft program and let you have it in the next 24, 48 hours. We have to check with Cindy as well about dates, because we need the quarterly report. Have you said dates? It's just that we are battling with, remember this month was set aside for all this stuff, and now we have to renegotiate with National Treasury to ensure the DG is here, and Tom Mariani, the Sales Commissioner, because they have to come for the quarterly report. And we want to do it within the next 2 weeks. We'll also speak to FAA, we're looking for a date. So because of the imponderables, you know, we can maybe look to topics and pass it around to members to look at. Okay, thanks. Over to you, Momo.
Not that it's a piece of art, but there's many ways of looking at the regulatory architecture, and I think that architecture is a word that the committee will have to keep in mind, I think, throughout, even though it's not mentioned in our, I think it's mentioned in the presentation. Because I think let me just make the point. There's no one way to regulate. There's no one way to do things. And there are a lot of judgment calls to be made. And importantly also, to take into account our specific history and culture, I think, of our regulators that we need to look at. So what we're going to do today is just to broadly give you an overview of the underlying thinking for moving to Twin Peaks. Just to remind all members in case, because not all members may have had the benefit of this. But we also want to just go through the bill, which, as we said to you, is now definitely with the state law advisor with the final version, and we hope that there will be, I think they should be pretty quick in certifying the bill, because they've been looking at previous versions and so on, so we don't anticipate that to be a major issue.
Because we're shaping the program, we don't want to keep changing. How long do you think they're likely to take? What's the maximum? In other words, we start planning for public hearing.
Look, we'll know later this week, but I think that there's a fair chance that it will be done in the next 2 weeks.
All right, so let's say at the outermost end of the month, as you mentioned.
Yes, and then I think just to get the proofs and so on, take part. Maybe another week, but...
Alright, so we target for public hearing around the 3rd week of September.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And then we still owe you, Chair, a more detailed a roadmap of that we still have to do. Okay, you'll get some of it here, but we'll give it to you more detail.
We tend to have a check conference with you guys on Monday, and then, of course, it's a holiday.
Yeah.
So we will stop that in.
Okay. Okay, so maybe just to move to the first slide. So I think when you look at Twin Peaks, that's why I think I've just got a set of questions, because I certainly don't want the impression to be created that we think we know everything and we think all matters are solved. And in fact, the nature of this area is such that I promise you until the last day that you pass the book, there'll be questions to be asked, and even after we pass the book. And I think that's just the nature of the beast in a sense. So, but you know, the big question is really how best to regulate the financial sector. If we really don't get too stuck, I think, in issues, that's the issue. And as you saw from the presentation on FSEP last week, the first issue is how best to regulate the sector globally. Is it possible to regulate it globally, given that your financial institutions, particularly banks, tend to operate globally? But of course, every country is sovereign, and they...
Which slide is that? We don't think of that. We're about...
We just updated the slide we were going to give you last week to be in a bit more detail. As I said, financial institutions, particularly banks, operate globally, but they obviously are regulated nationally only. Unless, of course, you're in the EU, but even there you've seen the problems you had around Greece, that you might try for regional regulation, but that can be very difficult unless you're one country like the United States. But there, too, they do have strong states. And, of course, the issue is how best, whatever the global story, how best is it to do it in South Africa itself? And what are the specific issues in South Africa that we need to take into account over and above whatever the global trends and so on are? I think the second question that we need to ask is, what are key lessons following the 2008 global financial crisis? I think here, the 2008 global financial crisis, some say it started in 2007, but really was a paradigm change type of event. In that, you know, up to 2008, if you even tried to go beyond light touch regulation, and I think types of questions, regulatory burden, etc., it was very hard to regulate. I mean, even financial sector. So even, for example, when there were laws on money laundering, which were first done, I think it was in the early 2000s, or let's take the FICE Act, which tried to regulate your intermediaries. It was well before I dealt with this area, but I understand there was a lot of resistance. And even when I started in this particular job in the Treasury, I remember talking to the banking, one of the previous banking registrars, who would just not look at certain issues. They didn't think they were their issues. Okay? And they would almost share the view of the industry that this was just a regulatory burden, and it was not for them to do it, but for somebody else to do it if they thought that was important. Of course, as I indicated to you, if you take money laundering, today the banks and everybody would bet us to do it because, as I said, other regulators are doing it overseas and they face massive fines if we don't do our job properly here and other regulators don't place reliance on our regulators here. So I guess, okay, just to use the analogy again, that this is like a nuclear energy facility, okay, whatever our issues, thoughts may be on nuclear, let's put that aside. But once you have a nuclear plant that's providing energy, yes, there are massive benefits, it's clean energy, maybe very expensive, but that's what it is. But there are big risks. And you only need one event, as we saw in Japan with, what is it, the Fukushima meltdown after the earthquake. You only need one event that could literally reverse the benefits of 50 years. So what one really needs to have continual monitoring. And like a nuclear facility, you can't sort of, when there's a problem, wait to phone the department and phone a bureaucrat like some of us or wait for a minister, or wait for cabinet, or anyone to make a decision. You have to act. And that's the important thing, that they are sort of empowered to act, and of course they may make mistakes in acting. But one shouldn't look too harshly on mistakes. I'm not talking about mistakes that leads to a nuclear explosion. I'm talking about small issues, okay? Because if they are independent, they have to be able to act, and act fast. The second point, I think, is when I say there was a paradigm shift, I think you heard from the IMF that's in Salek the last week. You know, it's institutions like these, the G20, are calling for intrusive, intensive, and effective supervision. These are their words. They are not our words. Yes, we might have used words like draconian, which it is, but those are the words of regulators. And this is to try and make the financial sector safer. The world has come close to meltdown in 2008. We were very, very close to it. I have looked out that personally that if the regulators did not act, we would have seen far worse. And we already see, I think, just how devastating the impact was. But it could have been worse. It wouldn't have been a recession. It would have been a depression. So, yeah, just then, when you say what are the key lessons, I think one of the other key lessons is, look, whatever the form, and you're not saying Twin Peaks is the only way. Some people have reformed regulators. But the quality, it's more the quality of the regulators, the type of people they have there, that matters more than the form. But I think even in recognizing that, over and above the prudential issues, that the issue of market conduct has come up, and it's recognized to be something that requires a dedicated focus. In fact, there's a lot of workshops now that Financial Stability Board is calling up on market conduct issues, because essentially, even the trigger, I don't think it was the cause, but the trigger to the global financial crisis were those subprime loans, where the banks were lending to people who really couldn't pay, and they gave them so-called teaser loans, and everybody sort of, you know, instead of giving 100% loan, you got 120%, and you paid nothing for 2 years, and then in 2 years' time, your property was now worth 150% of its value 2 years before, so then they refinanced it and gave you now 170% loan. And that's how this situation continued. And of course, you just needed the bubble on housing prices to burst before you saw the meltdown. So market conduct issues are important, and they can cause a systemic crisis. The third question, I think about, is why have we decided on a Twin Peaks model for regulating financial sector in South Africa? Why did we not, currently, as you know, you have bank supervision, which is a banking regulator, and a non-banking. So you've got banking and non-banking prudential regulatory system. Really, we felt that one needed to focus both on prudential and on market conduct objectives. So you've got two objectives, and we felt it's like to have two regulatory institutions, because the culture in South Africa was really to only focus on prudential. So, for example, when the Jali panel on banking released its report, in fact, it coincided in 2008, and we had to delay it slightly because of the crisis. We were worried about the impact of this report in that type of environment. But that really showed us that your prudential regulators were good at prudential, but they were lousy and actually not interested in market conduct. Okay, I always say that the blood of the central banker is good to look, make sure the institution's safe, but they probably not very good when it comes to looking at consumer protection issues. And that's largely because their focus is on looking at the safety of the entire system. And there is a tension between, you know, if you have, like we heard last week, a concentrated banking sector, you're going to have higher charges than you would in a competitive setting. But the point is that your profits are probably higher, which actually means that your banking system is probably safer, okay? There's less reason to take the type of risk that there is when there's free banking, like there was in the US, for example. So So there's a bit of a, there is a trade-off between market conduct and prudential. And we think that if you have a uniform system, just given the way our system works, that one of the objectives would be favored and that would be prudential. Whereas if you look at the UK, they also went away of one financial regulator. So they actually set up a financial services regulator, which was set up in the early 2000s. We almost followed that model, but for some reason we didn't carry it through. And in fact, their focus then was to be mainly on market conduct, and the central bank was sort of left out of the picture. And though there were great MOUs, they weren't worth the paper it was written on. And that really caused the sort of problems that you have. So, Chair, I think those are just the sorts of questions that I think you need to keep in mind all the time, and I think which we need to examine that we've really made progress against those types of questions. Perhaps in the hearings we need to identify, are those the questions to focus on? If we want to take a step back, are there other questions? I'll go through this pretty quickly, but you know, we made the choice to go in this direction in 2011 with what we call, I think Roy, you, of the entire document, or this 2011, the so-called red book. People in the financial sector perhaps didn't realize all our documents are red, but anyway. So I don't know why they call this a red book. The safer financial sector serves South Africa better. We outline why we, the rationale for Twin Peaks. We outline the principles that we had guiding this approach. And this document was approved by Cabinet, or the principles underlying it were approved. And it held the kind of announcement, well, the shift towards Twin Peaks in terms of announcement. At about the same time, this is a problem. You can't do Twin Peaks in one big bang. And I think last week there were issues of transitional risk. And in fact, because we have 11 or 12 different subsector acts in the financial sector, we really can't do this in one way. It would just be impossible, even if you had the staff and capacity to do 12 acts at the time, or to appeal 12 acts at the time. You've got to make sure that every issue catered for in those acts is catered for when you consolidate. So we went on to have a new securities laws, which is the whole Securities Act, Services Act. We had to move on credit rating agencies because they were deemed to have also not seen the crisis, and in fact gave triple E ratings to the subprime big players in the U.S., the very people who caused the problems, and so they were brought under the regulatory hat. Of course, then we had things imposed on us, like, we had to do Basel III. We then did a more general financial service general laws amendment act, and then we had to have another bank amendment act last year when the African bank crisis forced us to put that bill. And currently, I think the bills that we're talking about is the Twin Peaks Bill, the Financial Sector Regulation Bill. Like the Basel III Banks Amendment Act, there's an insurance bill waiting to implement SAM, which is the Prudential Framework for the insurance sector. There's a resolution bill that we're going to have, so that would take the Banks Amendment Bill, the Bank Amendment Act of the African Bank, will sort of take into account the new principles that internationally now apply for resolution when a financial institution is in trouble. And then, of course, we want to have one COFI bill, COFI, or Conduct of Financial Institutions Bill, which will govern market conduct. And Chair, the committee has had the hearing when we came and we talked about Tandi and her problems. We talked about market conduct about 2 months ago. So, Chair, this has been happening even whilst we're doing Twin Peaks. So you can see that it's very hard just to focus on Twin Peaks alone. Next slide. So, Chair, today the focus, of course, is only on Twin Peaks. And just for the record, after the publication of the Red Book in July, Cabinet approved the Twin Peaks principles. We then formed a financial sector regulatory reform steering committee, which was established with the staff and our financial services board. We went on a tour to other countries to look at the regulatory frameworks and what we could learn. And the outcome from it was a roadmap that we published in 2013 to implement the Twin Peaks model of financial regulation. And that basically laid the basis then for the first draft of the bill, which was published in December 2013. We took comments. The process actually took a bit longer than we anticipated and resulted then in over 300 pages of comments received and considered. But largely then led to the second bill, which was published in December 2014, exactly a year later. And Chair, there is a bill that's going to be tabled in Parliament, but what we've done is just following normal processes with bills. We published it for comment, we received further comments, and we had to take those things into account. We also had to deal with all kinds of issues that come up just to ensure that the bill is fully constitutional, because there are, as I said, draconian powers in the bill. Fortunately, you've seen some of them, like the Banks Amendment Act that we passed earlier this year. Okay, so that's the 2014 bill, and have you got the 300 pages in both places right? Exactly, okay, both times. So we've had lots of comments, and you know, we've been submitting the bill to the state board advisors and taking comments at the same time, so it's a bit of a moving target. I think of, I don't know why I say week of 17th August, I would say end of August that we expect the bill to be tabled, okay? 17th August or next week. I don't think that's right, okay? Yes, yes. I don't know where that 17th August. Yes. Yes, end of August, yes. End of August. You add, yeah. Yeah. No, no. Whatever it takes, we have the book. Yeah. Yeah. No, it will be. No, it will be, Chair. It will be. Okay. Next slide? Okay. Roy, you want to start talk through some of these slides? Kathy, feel free to summarize.
Thank you very much. So just obviously the crucial role of the financial sector in the economy, I mean, question is why do we regulate? It's very important to understand how important the financial service sector is in the economy. Generally, it's a very important sector in terms of delivering balanced and sustainable economic growth. For South Africa, in addition, it is an incredibly important part of our advantage, I think, both in the continent and internationally. We have one of the best regulated financial services sectors in the world, and it's a huge employer, and it provides substantial tax revenue and so forth and so forth, so it's a very important sector. But there are three main risk categories that require regulation. The first is the financial stability aspect. So internationally, when banks fail, they impose enormous financial risks on an economy. So it's very important to have a proper system of regulation from a stability perspective. And linked to that is the idea of prudential supervision, which really talks to the fact that many people rely on the financial services sector for savings and for their deposits and so forth. And so when they provide money to a bank, for example, in deposits, they hope that the bank will survive and be able to pay back their deposits. Similarly, when you take out an insurance policy and you drive your car into a wall, you do hope that the insurance company will be there for you when that happens. So there is a requirement for there to be a supervisory system to ensure that there is prudential supervision of insurance. In addition, as Mona has highlighted, the way in which financial services firms engage with their clients is very important. know that because of the nature of the financial service sector, it's very highly concentrated, they're quite expensive. And so there is also a role to ensure that they appropriately disclose their costs and their fees and so forth. And there may be tensions between the objectives of the ability to potentially financial customers and other objectives like ensuring financial market integrity, which talks about any money laundering and so forth, and inclusion. And I'll talk about that in a bit more detail later. And if we're obviously the sector is crucial in terms of trade, investments, and so forth. And why it's different? Buying a product from a financial services firm is not like buying a toaster. So that's why we have a toaster over there. You must use a product over a very long period of time. If you think about contributing to a pension plan, you probably contribute to a pension plan over your entire life. It's probably maybe the same pension plan or a related pension plan, and so you really expect that when you're 65 and retired that there will be money available for you. It's not an ordinary product in that context. Also, many of your savings on bank accounts, savings may also be other instruments like collective investment schemes, known as unit trusts. And because of this particular strangeness about financial products that you buy them quite infrequently and you tend to hang on to them for a very long period of time, the buyers of the products are often at a disadvantage compared to the sellers, something we call asymmetry of information. And so the sellers will often have substantially more information about financial markets than the average buyer of the products. And there are very important ways in which we can ensure that the information imbalance is mitigated between buyers and sellers. And that, I think, was what came out last in the market conduct framework, is particularly about ensuring that there's disclosure of information from the one side to the other. So in short, buying a product is not really like buying a toaster, so you need higher standards, and you need higher standards. We have quite a good system of consumer protection in this country, and the Consumer Protection Act, for example, but financial services isn't really fitting terribly well with that framework, and so we need a higher system of standards in consumer protection. So just to dig a bit into what are the two ways in which we try and protect customers. So the first way, as I said, is that we need to make sure that the financial institution can meet its obligations. So when you take out a policy from an insurance company, there's obligation that when you drive your car into wall, that the insurance company will be able to provide you that obligation. So you need to think about, does the insurance company have a sustainable business model? How does it invest the money that you've given it for policy? And when it fails, or if it fails, how do we resolve it? So that's a big area of work, which we'll explain a bit later. But if you can design the system in such a way that actually if there's ever a failure of an insurance company, it can pass on the obligations to a new company, then to some extent you're protecting customers also. That's also how we think about failures of banks, is that when a bank fails, the deposits that an individual has given to the bank are passed on to another company. So when Sambo went into curatorship, the deposit book was moved across to another bank and probably lost money. African Bank was slightly different, as the committee will recall when we did African Bank presentation. So prudential, we call it prudential regulation because it's about being prudent. It's about the safety and soundness of individual firms and ensures the firm is running in a prudent manner. So basically, it says the financial service firm, don't invest in stupid investments, don't take on too much risk. Then, as I said, there's also a really important requirement that the institution sells its product appropriately, disclosures, costs, fine print, etc. And that's what we call market conduct regulation, which is concerned with how the individual firm behaves with its customers and to some extent behaves with other firms. So the most interesting component of two firms engaging with each other is your pension fund, which is managed by a board of trustees. It will buy products from very sophisticated fund managers, for example. And so there's also requirements to ensure that there is appropriate levels of disclosure and information, even between firms. Also, we saw the LIBOR scandal. You have seen that earlier this week, the gentleman that caused the LIBOR scandal was put in jail for longer than a murderer, which was really interesting. And that is when a very sophisticated individual actually manipulate the markets to ensure that they make profits. And that actually has very big implications for the system generally.
example, not all of us know it. Can you simplify it, right? Because remember, we're not going to have this grounding. And my job as a chair, whether I understand it or you don't know it, that's the average thing I understand. And just because I don't understand it. So let's not cover that grounding. Explain simply what you're saying. I don't know this.
Okay. So the LIBOR scandal was very interesting. So LIBOR stands for the London Bank Overnight Rate. And what it is an interest rate in London, and it's kind of a benchmark interest rate. So almost all interest rates around the world are benchmark back to this interest rate. And the way it used to be calculated is that if about a group of banks used to submit their average interest rate to this committee, which is actually the Banking Association in London, and they would calculate kind of an average rate, and they would publish that, and that was kind of seen as the benchmark rate, as in the rate at which everything would function around. Now, it's very straightforward. There's only a few of you that we can phone each other, and we could send in a different rate, and then you would know what the benchmark rate would look like because you had submitted, you and your mates had actually submitted the rate, and there's some fantastic transcripts of conversations between you guys and what they were saying to each other about getting the rates right. So they submitted these rates that were out of line with the rest of the market, and as a result, the rate was out of sync, and actually it caused quite a lot of losses to people throughout the system. So
out of sync, you mean they manipulated to suit their book.
To suit their book.
And so you've had major fines imposed on major banks overseas.
So our Reserve Bank went through a whole process of reviewing our interbank rate. We also have one called the Johannesburg Interbank Acceptance Check, JIBAR, and there's a whole review that's available on the Reserve Bank website. And they've also, they didn't find any evidence of any manipulation in our interbank rate, but they have made a number of proposals to improve the manner in which it's calculated to make sure that there isn't a possibility of manipulation. So that would be what we would call wholesale market conduct regulation. Because it's not just about a firm and its customers, it's also about how the system interacts with each other. So how does TwinPeaks go about improving the system? Well, we're thinking about two objectives and two supervisors. As Momo said, is when you mix up objectives and supervisors, you can get into difficulties. Both fall under one law, one minister, and one framework. There's dedicated equal emphasis on the different risks. And financial stability, which we'll talk about in a bit more detail later, is left to a third and bigger regulator, which is the Reserve Bank. We call them the bigger regulator because they have additional powers which are granted to them under the Reserve Bank Act, under the Currency Exchanges Act, and under their usual day-to-day monetary policy operations. So this will increase the regulatory coverage. It will be more complete, harmonized, integrated, proportionate. It will enhance macroprudential regulation for banks, insurance, financial markets, and conglomerates. So just to highlight why we use the word macroprudential and not prudential, is that I spoke about prudential being thinking about how firms look after themselves. Microprudential means how individual firms, so it's at kind of the micro level, how individual firms ensure that they are safe and sound. Then the focus is more on outcomes, so we are looking at more on what is the outcome of the process, and I think that probably was covered in a lot of detail in the market conduct framework around the key outcomes we're trying to achieve there, and also how are we more efficient in using the supervisory capacity that we have, and also making sure that we can take strong and swift action for contraventions of the law. I think Momo's gone into a bit of detail already about that there are many ways of looking at how regulators can be structured. I'm sure in the public vision and in the press there's been quite a lot of debate about is TwinPeaks the right approach. Some people say yes, some people say no. I think it's in many ways an academic question, but it is a very interesting question. So we feel the single regulator is not really appropriate for South Africa. There have been lots of problems with single regulators across the world. One successful example, however, is Germany. They have a single regulator called BaFin. The UK had a single regulator called the Financial Services Authority, which didn't really work that well. So it can work in some jurisdictions, in other jurisdictions not so well.
Even Germany, they've got a weak conduct
history. Yeah, it's very prudential.
That's an example of where protectors, the courts have been very much in the Philippines, and
my thoughts on the conversation. Yeah, very right. And then institutional is where you basically look, you supervise every little household firm. You have a banking registrar, you have a credit person, you have an insurance person, a pensions person, which is kind of what we have at the moment. The really interesting thing about it is that there are very subtle lines between different types of financial institutions. So if you think about your pension, you might think that you actually have a pension, but you actually probably have an insurance product behind that pension. So what has probably happened is the money you put in your pension stuff has been used to invest in a long-term insurance product. Or the money that you put in your pension has actually gone into collective investments into unit trust, which is a very sensible place for it to go. But if you don't think carefully about how you supervise pensions and collective investment schemes, or pensions and unit trusts, or pensions and insurance, you might end up with these really strange outcomes that you actually, one lot is falling behind the other lot, or you must do it all at the same time. So we've tried really hard when we do our pension reforms to do insurance reforms at the same time, or but it becomes more and more complex. It actually makes sense to supervise in a more consistent way across the system. And then there are a whole bunch of other people out there, the Financial Intelligence Center, the Exchange Control Department, the Council of Medical Schemes. So there's quite a lot of stuff going out there. It's very fragmented, and that is often what happens when you have this kind of approach. That kind of gives you a flavor to why we have gone for a more twin peak approach, which is more focused on outcomes. Then Cabinet should approve these regulatory principles, which says that providers must be appropriately licensed or regulated. I'm not going to go through a lot of detail. I think we have covered these in our earlier briefings on 20th. But it's very important that the most important thing, I think, on these principles is to ensure coordination between our regulators.
Chair, just to give an example, though, without going through all, if you take the first principle, which is that anyone who provides financial service must be regulated or licensed. Appropriately. And I think that those principles are important because there were days when many players were not required to get a license or whatever, and that's when you see major abuses. Obviously, the people who do put on the schemes and saw those register. So you always have those who are out of the system. But you do want a situation where just providing a service and staying outside the system also becomes a sort of crime to some extent. So it's not like, you know, if you have those things, you don't need any approval. But if you're going to be involved in financial services, you do need an approval. So, you know, one can go through all of these line by line. We've talked about independence of the regulators, operational independence, etc., SIFIs, etc., you know.
And we have also spoken to you about last week about all these peer reviews we go through. So we discussed last week we had this G20 peer review where countries similar to us come and they give us advice on how what they think happens in their jurisdiction, etc. And almost consistently we get the message that there's poor coordination between our various regulators, which is not surprising considering we have so many of them. It's quite hard to coordinate. I think we have 13 or 14 different regulators for financial services.
But just on that, so to add to what Roy is saying, so I guess what you're saying, sometimes there's poor coordination because there's structural fragmentation. Okay. Now, if you have many regulators, it just becomes very hard. If you have two, it's a bit easier. Okay. Then the issue is, though, even if you have two or three, is coordination... Can there be other reasons for poor coordination? Well, I guess in the UK, if you looked at it, the issue was they did have MOUs between the Bank of England and Financial Services Authority. Yet, you know, the MOU really was probably not worth the paper it was written on. Because the coordination is easier said than done. To actually do it does require quite a culture change as well. So if one goes to a country like Australia as opposed to the UK, what we found was the culture there of coordination doesn't have to be written in law, But in Australia, it's just a natural way in which people work. So they don't really need laws to say thou shalt coordinate. Whereas now in the UK, they actually have laws to say thou shalt coordinate, comply or explain, etc., etc. So it depends on the culture of your regulators and whether they work together.
You almost expect a group team building because the whole system. And in addition, more recently, Cabinet has approved the publication of this framework for market conduct regulation, which is transparent, comprehensive, appropriate, etc. And I think you have seen quite a lot of detail on that framework.
I just wanted to deal with this issue because I guess the other thing we want the committee to do to us is to be skeptical, okay? The next slide, right? While we're asking and dealing with you, okay? Because it's like coordination. We might say coordination. We've also got a form of coordination. But will it actually work is the question you have to ask. Are we being consistent? Now, I just want to give a perspective from the other side. Let's say you're a bank, okay? You could choose any of them, Standard Bank, EFSA, any of the big four, okay? Let's consider what the regulatory system means for them. And maybe you should call them and ask them, okay? So generally you would find that they're financial groups, so they have a banking institution. The same bank also does credit. They've got a long-term insurance license, a short-term insurance license. They'll have various investment licenses. They may even look after retirement funds. In most cases, they do. So they'll have a license for retirement funds. And then they tend to also have their own medical scheme, some company linked to them. So they have to get one for medical schemes. They obviously also have to deal with the FIC, money laundering, each of them, they have to deal with the Competitions Commission, okay. Not all of them are necessarily financial regulators. The Competitions Commission, for example, does, you know, deals with other companies as well. But you see that there's a plethora of regulators, okay. Now, even when we have Twin Peaks, or if you take the current system with Banking Supervision and Financial Services Board, like Roy has said, the FSB actually has many regulators. Okay, we're changing that in Twin Peaks so that there's just two. Because at the moment, if you deal with the FSB, you have to deal with each insurance, long-term insurance, short-term insurance. That's why we have an act for each of those. But over and above that, any bank will also have to deal, have a national credit regulator license. It will, as I said, have to get some license from the Council of Medical Schemes. It has to deal with all these institutions. And this is the other problem. Each regulator there has a different licensing system. Okay. Now, I'm not saying that they would be the same, but even the approach to licensing is radically different, as if you have two different countries. They each have their own tribunal, if they have a tribunal. They each have their own ombuds. Some have voluntary, some have statutory. Some are real ombuds, you know, really independent, and some are like puppies for the industry, okay? Because the industry pays for it, okay? So, very different. Now, over and above that, they also are listed companies, so they have to deal with the JSC. They may or may not have to deal with the CIPC. What's it? Companies, intellectual, property, whatever, right? They have to deal with the Department of Justice. For example, there's a POPI Act, they have to comply. But even debt collectors are regulated by the Department of Justice. All your emolument attachment orders, all the problem of indebtedness falls under a completely different department that doesn't, for example, looks at issues given where they are legal, okay, rather than from a market conduct or financial perspective. So the question, I guess, that needs to ask is, how do all these regulators coordinate their activities? Actually, they don't, in my view. I mean, they do a little bit, but do they really? Not really, I think. Okay? And the horrible secret, even from the UK, was regulators actually all work in silos. And I can tell you in South Africa, when I've spoken to all regulators, as I said earlier, they will refuse to do other people's work. You know, banking legislature, you refuse to deal with money laundering issues, okay? And there used to be fights. It's, the situation has improved, but that's the problem. So, you know, you need to see that they are effectively operate as one if you want to prevent regulatory arbitrage. And also from the perspective of companies, even if you had all of this, are we at least trying to reduce or minimize the cost of regulation and supervision? Now, that's not to get it to zero, but to the extent that you have a system, you should at least try and minimize the cost. And bear in mind, under Twin Feet, we are going to be imposing a levy on the financial sector because they must pay for their own regulation. But there is a duty on us to make sure that we're not wasting that expenditure and it's actually used effectively and efficiently, like any tax revenue that you get. I think the big question that we've asked is, do MOUs really work when there's structural fragmentation? And I've talked about, you know, the other countries. So I think it's good to just get this perspective from the other side as well, not just from our side as government, where we have a plethora of regulators, and there's no real duty. We never held accountable. We never hold our regulators accountable because it's very hard to hold them accountable. You see that they are really coordinating their activities and operating almost seamlessly as one regulatory kind of, not entity, but approach or system. Uh-huh. Now, you've left out all FIC and others, but anyway.
Yes, I have. This is part of the version of the world. In the sense, this is basically what we have at the moment, where there are three regulators are the Reserve Bank, the SSB and the MCR. The Reserve Bank looks after the Banks Act, the Mutual and Cooperative Bank Acts. The SSB, there is a registrar for long-term insurance and short-term insurance, for collective investment schemes, which are unit trusts, for pensions, for financial advisory intermediary services, and for a few others too, pre-rating services, etc. And under that is a inspection act, which gives them powers to inspect financial institutions. Then there is also the National Credit Regulator, and they have a National Credit Act. And then there are a few that I've been sort of quite, I ran out of space on the right-hand side. So there's the FIC, and so forth.
No, but I also think these are those the core in terms of financial regulators. And I think it's important to recognize that. I know some of our colleagues may differ with us. So if you look at the National Credit Regulator, the problem is 90%, I forget the exact figure, of lending is done by banks. Okay. You can't have, let's say, the NCR suspending a bank's license to do credit tomorrow. That bank will crash. It will cause a systemic crisis, okay? And what you effectively have is for a bank, you know, the one side of the book is regulated by the NCR. In a sense, the other side is by the banking supervision, okay? We just can't have no coordination between them, okay? So for one institution, I'm saying, banks, that applies less to insurance, although some insurance companies do lending as well. Of course, there's a whole lot of micro lenders and all that who also hold, and furniture stores and you name them, anyone who gives credit who also needs the NCR license. But that's just a point to note from the banking side, the NCR is a very important regulator.
So it's quite important to pause on the side and see how the world works at the moment, because in the first phase of 20, which is what the bill is doing, we're not going to fiddle too much with the little boxes at the bottom. So we're not replacing the Bank Act, we're not replacing the Long-Term Insurance Act and so forth. We're keeping all those acts in place, which helps with transitional risks. In the second phase of Twin Peaks, which starts next year, we will start replacing the laws underneath each of the regulators. So the first one on the schedule is to combine the Long-Term Insurance, Short-Term Insurance Act into a new act called the Insurance Act, and to talk about how that Insurance Act will fit into the fees. So that really helps with the transitional risks because it means that for an insurance company, there is very little impact immediately from the fee system. they will see the impact actually when the Insurance Act comes next year. Similarly, we will probably make changes to the other laws as we go along. So we have a whole schedule for this. So we'll get really tired of chair. I think the previous committee also got really tired of financial distortion. So we'll probably have a schedule for quite a while as we go along. The next slide tries to actually show this phase one process. So now, under the prudential authority, the Banks Act will still be supervised by the prudential authority. Then parts of the insurance that relates to how insurance conducts, looks after its balance sheet in its business will also be done by the prudential authority, and the whole approach called solvency assessment and management, that will be done by the prudential authority. And they will do a little bit of collective investment schemes, mainly money market funds, which relate to those who want to have the most risk. The other act will remain so CIS, pensions, phase, financial markets. They will be looked after by the Financial Services Conduct Authority, and that is essentially a transformed FSB. Then there will be enhanced coordination between the Conduct Authority and the other Conduct Authorities. So that is obviously something that has come up quite a lot in the comments, and I'm sure it will come up a lot in the public submissions, is that we are now moving to a world of two Conduct Authorities. And underpinning all of this is a new tribunal called the Financial Services Tribunal. Previously, this function was done by a board of review and by by the FSB appeal board. So we're trying to streamline things and combine things as well. And then there is also going to be a new committee which is going to help to get coordination working better, which is to Financial Stability Oversight Committee, and the trade industry has felt strongly, and I think they're correct, we agree with them strongly, the NCR is an equal member, which you'll see is a big change from the 2013 board.
Okay. But the chair, the point here is even at the tribunal level, there'll be a different one for credit, different one for everyone else. So the questions we ask is there not scope for some rationalization? Because that tribunal, for example, covers both credit and competition, okay? Sorry, and sorry, consumer protection. So the reasons for it, but I'm just saying that there's lots of questions that one can ask, and I think it's important that you ask the questions to see whether we've got the system right, and why we're saying it's important to get the other committees in Parliament, I think, to come in certainly to get their view. Roy's also forgotten, for example, he's not forgotten, he probably couldn't put it in, is the Ombuds system. So as I said, that would have many more splits. And even there now, we are looking at can we create a super consumer office, say, okay, even if there are separate ones for each of the activities. We don't want to push that immediately, but really down the line, that's the question we need, because which ombuds do you go to? Like Roy said, you don't even know that your pension fund has an underlying insurance. So you may even be going to the wrong ones, depending on the product. It's impossible for consumers to know. So I think that there are issues like those that certainly one can continue to talk about ad infinitum.
And then, Chair, you'll remember we did quite a comprehensive briefing to the committee on what we learned from the failure of African banks. And just a summary slide of that presentation. But it was very clear that these things that, you know, had come up in our peer reviews and we had put out in our red book about coordination and about those things very much came to the fore in the QH of African Bank. And also there were other issues which came to the fore, and I think I explained about the fact that it's a bit of a funny animal where you've got a listed investments holding company called African Bank Investors Limited. It has three subsidiaries, as you remember, the bank, the insurance company, and the furniture company, and the furniture company kind of was the one that caused all the problems. So you will see there's a whole chapter on which is our first step towards dealing with conglomerates. And there are questions about to what extent, you know, to what extent were the regulatory failures in this process. I think we learned a lot. We have had two big inquiries, both internally at the bank and externally by Edward Marburg. So the big issues to be considered in all are how to respond to the EFSA recommendations, what approach are we doing for regulating financial groups, how do we deal with systemically important financial institutions, and can we agree on principles for coordination between our regulators. And the bill, to some extent, tries to do this by being a holistic approach to the scope and objectives. It provides for an approach to licensing. It provides for new regulation-making powers. We'll go through all of this in detail when we get there. How supervision happens, how information gathering happens, and how enforcement happens. So we have included quite a bit, that's why the bill has been quite an interesting one to draft, because there have been quite a few cases around, for example, our information gathering powers in the Financial Inspections Act, which we've included quite useful judgments in terms of enforcement actions, and quite useful inputs also in terms of civil and regulations. So all of those have been included, and we'll explain those as we go through the bill. We'll explain how we've done it. It's very important that these two authorities, the Twin Heath, are really just the first step. And then, before we get to the bill, Mohamed briefly touched on the role of the NGR. As I said, it is the other market conduct regulator. We have expressly provided for it within the Twin Peaks system. It is an equal to the Prudential Authority and the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. There are coordination mechanisms to ensure regulatory cooperation, coordination and consistency in how they work. It is a member of the FSOC. There is a role for the Trade and Industry Department on our Council of Financial Regulators, which is one of our coordination mechanisms. But there are challenges in terms of how we meet the F7 G20 peer review concerns about how these regulators will interact with each other. And also, as we've said, there are quite a lot of other people, other regulators around the Financial Intelligence Center, Council of Medical Students, and so forth.
So, you know, and part of the reason why when we took public comments obviously gets to what a financial service, have we defined it properly, who the financial service regulate, because many regulate the non-financial sector as well. So I've talked about, if you look at this list, you know, let me just focus on ourselves, because even within the Minister of Finance powers and the Reserve Bank, as I said, you get the, not just the government, you get the FIC, you get FATA, or you know, the regulators of the payment systems. Once you get out of the Minister of Finance's mandate, you get the Council for Medical Schemes. Okay, it's really a financial product, and then as we said, there's the Competition Commission, which plays a role. And remember, the Competition Commission is also currently undertaking an investigation against collusion. Now, what's their relationship with the SARB? Because down the line, I think what you want is when one regulator acts, they need to work with the prudential regulators to at least ensure there's no systemic risk. And that's why you find that even in the current Banks Act, when it comes to the Competition Act, there's a waiver that applies when it comes to merger and acquisition of a bank. And that's just to take into account the fact that when you deal with the banking sector or the financial sector, but certainly the banking sector, these issues, you know, need to be looked at from a stability perspective as well, because in a sense we are where we are. We want more competition, but how do you also ensure there's stability in the process? And the processes around banks have to be very quick. If you're going to find a bank, you need to sort it out quickly. Not, it shouldn't take forever. And that's why you see, even overseas, when banks are fined, they tend not to go to court. They actually want the issue dealt with quickly. There's a long negotiations with the Department of Justice in the U.S. and the regulators, or the Serious Fraud Office and the FCA in the U.K. And of course, we've talked about the CIPC and the Financial Reporting Standards Council, which are in terms of the Companies Act. These have all been raised to the FCAP, and as you saw last week, that there's also issues around the accounting and auditing standards, which obviously are meant to apply beyond the financial sector, but there are issues of what is fair value and so on in the banking sector. These are all issues that have been taken up internationally by regulators. So, you know, there's a point at which you've got to draw a line, and you can't really try and cover everything, because before you know it, you'll be covering the health inspectors who come and inspect the environmental inspectors who come into a bank building. That we certainly don't want issues as net. But there are issues around the financial services that are impacted by all these other regulators.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Thank you. You brought in the libel issue, right? Would Trinity's fully implemented prevent the libel occurring in our whatever we call it for interest discrimination? I mean, what is the connection between that example and this legislation essentially is my question. The question of levies and paying for the film, and principle and reference, but the extent of levies and determination of levies. We talk about nuclear, we've got the energy regulator, and you know, there's a whole lot of input and control over what our tariffs are going to be. What are those kind of safeguards that are going to be put, or just in broad terms? I mean, you're going to the detail in the bill in due course, but are there any? That should be my question. And currently the FSB, my understanding is that those top guys, they earn like 6-7 times what I get paid as an MP. 15, I don't know if that's true or not. Perhaps you can just give me some comments on that. And so, I'm thinking that's the list, because you can, it's lovely to have the monopoly on the market that's predetermined, and you can then just maybe whatever you want to cover whatever cost you want. And then what oversight would we as Parliament have over that whole process? With regard to all the plethora, as you quite rightly say, of market conduct and so on, and whilst you're putting them into two teeth, none of them disappear, or am I wrong? We simply bunching them together under a single structure. So they will continue to operate, but they will, the coordination between them then is so much easier because they're under a single structure, except that. But there's really, you quite rightly said you must try and make it as cost effective as possible. Does this in fact do any of that? Does the tribunal, for instance, replace 10 tribunals? And so on, and the cost. So it's just in broad terms, the detail will come to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. On slide 5, you noted the bill that's lodged with the state law advisor, and you received comments from the state law advisor. I wonder if you could outline us on the key factors raised by the state law advisor, particularly if any of those factors are constitutional matters, and if they are constitutional matters, if you could outline those constitutional matters. The second is, what do you estimate financial implications of the bill to be in effect of the state, but then also the issue my colleague raised in respect of levies on financial institutions?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just need a clarity here. Mama presented, I don't know who presented it, I can't remember, but, you know, I'm failing to see a difference between the current regulatory architecture and the proposed regulatory architecture, except for the introduction of that super tribunal. But basically what I see under each one of them, they remain more or less the same. And I would love to get clarity on that. The other one is that I see that under market conduct now, we have put Financial Services Conduct Authority. Is that new name for FSB? I just need to confirm that, if that's new name for FSB. And again, I want to know what's going to happen to the cooperatives, because previously SARB was the regulatory authority over them, but I don't necessarily see them now under Prudential, but and just in the old architecture. Now I don't know what's going to be happening to them. I'm also unable to draw a distinction around how the pension funds are going to be regulated. Which aspects are all the aspects of the pension fund, since you put the entire Pension Fund Act under the Financial Services Conduct Authority? Are they going to remain there with FSB, or is there any aspect, especially when it comes to investment of the funds and what if you're going to be? I'm not sure. I just need clarity around this architecture. Unfortunately, it just didn't come very clear to me, and even the slides, the way they are presented today, put them as not that different, and I'm failing to get that distinction. If you could kindly help me with that. Finally, Mamo, you keep on mentioning this parent, and this point was also mentioned by that gentleman from the IMF. I'm very concerned about this matter of this nuclear thing coming up all the time as a risk issue, because I know, obviously, we have not engaged with other committees as this standing committee, but the committee on energy is probably looking at those issues. The issue of the nuclear energy is actually been on the newspapers, it's been everywhere, and I'm not sure whether it's just a by-the-way kind of thing that you are mentioning, and it is concerning from where I am sitting, because if we are going to allow it to continue, and yet we know that, you know, the inherent risks that come with that, without us coming out clearly and openly about it, I'm very concerned that it may actually put South Africa in a different light. And I think we need to, if this is really an issue, then let it be put clearly, and then let it be clear that it's put on the table as a major risk factor, rather than raising it as a by-the-way thing, because if that is done, then we are not going to be able to tackle it, because we will think that it's not like a significant matter. The reason I'm raising it is because even the IMF gentleman raised it, and you also certainly referred to it this morning, and we know that it's a matter that is currently on the top of the newspapers and everywhere. Thank you.
At the moment, right, in the
ask the gauge of the financial institution earlier for themselves when they come to public hearing. What are the difficulties with the financial institution that are being regulated? Obviously, they will speak for themselves when they appear before Parliament. But for now, what are three to five of the key problems they have with the current version of the bill, right? The way it is. Secondly, on the National Credit Act, that falls under the Department of Trade and Industry. So presumably you've been engaging with them. This bill went through Cabinet. Cabinet is one single entity, as it were. Presumably the Minister and DG, others in DGI, are at ease with this set of proposals as the impact on the credit regulator. we're always engaged, as you said, yes, they must do so reasonably soon. With the committee here, we've been through this before. We had two separate departments appearing before committee, each arguing its own case, and he's saying to them, you must go to cabinet and talk these issues out. And you can't come to parliament and fight your own individual. There's one cabinet, right? So, what I'm saying is that, to what extent is there a consensus or agreement between DGI and NT on this treatment of the National Credit Act? Then I don't know if you're a citizen, if you're a citizen, understand what you mean. You said there's difficulty making a general sort of statement globally about holding regulators to account. What do you mean by that, if that's really what you say? There's something that I don't understand, but maybe I can put you on the phone. It's more of my own slightly technical issues and some things you're saying. On the issue of Makosi rate, it's not the first time she's been here. As it happened, I did meet with the DA last week, Wednesday. When I heard David, he wasn't actually saying that he wants us to overhaul the entire program. He had six or so, most of them are in some form of them being addressed by the committee. One of the two that isn't at least on our overt program is the criminal Makosi's rating, which is we're getting pretty close from what we can gather to procurement process open up. And there's no understanding within this parliament about the financial implications. And we have discussed this before, committee members, let me remind us all, that if we were to say that there are financial implications, therefore this committee must consider, then we must become this one committee in Parliament, with everything, whether it's e-tolling, nuclear, local government, everything would fall under us. And we're not in a position, this Parliament doesn't allow it, those changes would sort us out. So what I think, of course, you've raised, I have raised it with the chair of energy. About 2 months ago when he first raised this. And he was in principle fine. We then decided that we might bring more committees. I will, in fact, raise it again today. This is 2-3 feet away from me. Raise it again with him. But we won't do it on our own. We have to do it with the energy committee and maybe public enterprise. I don't know. But we can't just go ahead and say, because it is funded for finance and meet on the phone. So that is on the agenda, of course. And whether you use the example here appropriately is irrelevant. Just part of it is a hope. The Finance Committee and the relevant committees need to bring this. We can't sort of like run away from it. I don't think anybody wants to. It's about getting the Energy Committee to lead. And they have already, from what I can gather, in the Sunday or Daily Times last Wednesday, in fact, I did speak to the chair about it. They have raised the question, not recently, I just quoted the thing. We need to know what the financial implications are of this nuclear project. That's on the agenda, of course. In some form or another, I will proceed with the decision took some months ago that we should engage with energy around this and see that when they're meeting, maybe they should call a meeting and we should attend it. Because you see, you don't start simply with financial implications. You look at your energy needs. And then you decide what you need and what form the need will be met. And then you look at the implications and then say, well, can we do it or can't we do it? So we don't start from this thing of plans and sets. That will be a wrong way of going about it. At least that's, I think, the majority party method and the other parties. So I think energy will call the meeting jointly with us and public enterprise. Can we reveal that I do that? In fact, this will be formally right to them. We're not engaging formally. Okay. So coming back to the questions, sorry. Yeah.
I do think it's important, as you say, that we do have an opportunity to consider the financial implications of the possible nuclear build program, and it probably does make sense to do so in a joint committee environment. My concern is particularly that it's imperative that National Treasury do a presentation at that joint meeting so that we can get National Treasury's assessment of the financial implications, which might be very different from other departments.
Yeah, one cabinet and one government, so presumably you confer all the time on these issues, and we can give National Treasury input, but I can't see that you're going to end up in Parliament with two fundamentally different assessments of the... Sorry? Yeah, they're forced to act out. I'll take it on another issue, which is I don't want GTI to come and lobby us now. Those are over, Mom. I have wonderful anecdotes about you as well. But I won't say it. You know this, right? And the problem is that you're at the temperate way you can't think. This is what we think, and we'd like to hear from what you say. It's a little bit style of substance for my feeling. I don't know. But I think as you get older, me too, I'm much more reflective. You saw me when I was 18. I was very clear, the world social to look at what's going to occur in my lifetime. I'm a bit more temperate and modest about it now. So we think, I think our influence is more than the same. I'm teasing you, but also being serious about actually hoping that when DCI is what the issues are. Right. Okay, over to you, Momo, and your team.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Now, let me just start with the nuclear story. It was an analogy which we used years ago when we started. Okay, as our views were explained. And let me say, I'm not getting into cost and so on. I'm saying, and we do have a nuclear facility currently. You need to make sure that it's safe all the time. Therefore, you do have a nuclear energy regulator, okay? And therefore, you want the regulator, and we are talking from a regulatory perspective, so it's there, it delivers energy, we need the energy, and you just need to make sure the regulator is making sure that the normal safety practices that are international in nature are adhered to. So the financial sector is the same. I think that the only reason the analogy was used was to say in 2008 you really had a meltdown in the world. Okay, this thing, a financial crisis has got enormous negative consequences if it explodes. And that's why you call these things, some of them, SIFIs today, okay, because they pose systemic risk, not just to the rest of the financial sector, but to the economy in their country, and to other countries that are connected. As we saw, something happened with Lehman. 1 million people lost their jobs in South Africa. And if it was a depression, it would have been far worse, okay. So, it's in that context, it's certainly not a comment on nuclear. In the same way, I've used the parallel of a plane. That if you're flying a plane, you know, you can be scared because of crashes, but that doesn't mean you stop flying. You just ensure that you reduce, the regulators have to reduce the risk, make sure the planes are, whatever they have to do, there's international practices that apply. So I think, Chair, see this from the regulatory perspective, okay, that once something is there, there are huge benefits, whether it's energy, whether it's flying, whether it's whatever, okay. But there are risks, and certainly the risks are controllable. You can control them. But to control them, you need not just good regulation, and I haven't come to what is regulation and what is supervision. You need good supervision so someone doesn't leave a boat there by mistake. I mean, you need to, do you think there are proper practices, and you need to make sure your regulators are on board. So that's the context. But so the point to note is the financial sector can bring us down. We need to not ever take it for granted. We need to make sure the regulators are doing their job all the time and that they're doing it well. And that gets to accountability. So when you have a problem, obviously one needs to ask, why did we have the problem? I mean, let's take African banks. After the event, or you've had whatever, you hope regulators are asking, what could I have done better? Okay. The problem when you regulate is people expect them to play God. And there's no such thing as there will never be a bank failure. There will be bank failures, even with good regulation. Similarly, there may be a libel type scandal. We can't guarantee that it won't happen. But yes, it will be less likely to happen because before it was clear the regulators didn't shine their torch in the area of libel or, as we now say, benchmarks, financial sector benchmarks which operate. Now the regulators are looking at it, and that's why we don't use words like consumer protection or customer protection. Market conduct goes beyond it. It's how you conduct your business. Do you do it in the most ethical way? Do you do it in a way which would make the front page of the Sunday Times? You won't be embarrassed. Okay. So those are the sort of issues. And to the extent that the question was asked, what's different? The big difference is, firstly, there are two big differences. Firstly, that the SOC is going to look after financial stability more explicitly. And later, there's a slide that I said, when you look at the SOC, think of it as not just one creature. There's a SOC where the governor is the boss, okay? But within that, there's a prudential authority where, in terms of the bill, one of the deputy governors will be the chief executive. That's a juristic, what would you call it, entity within the SOC, okay? It's not an entity, but it's the SOC, sorry, a separate juristic person, okay? The SOC currently has an ExCon or Financial Surveillance Department. They do certain things which other central banks may or may not do. The SOC oversees the payment system in South Africa. That is not necessarily something that all central banks may do. They may or may not. Okay. So if you go into Australia, you'll see that in their Twin Peaks, the prudential authority doesn't fall within the central bank. In the UK, the Financial Services Authority was created outside the Bank of England. And they found that they've not only brought it back, and they said they would have a separate entity, but last week they even questioned it being an entity, a subsidiary. So it seems they're coming more towards the thinking that we've had because we couldn't see it operating as a subsidiary as such. So these are a lot of hard questions that we have to look at. So, but of course, then there's a market conduct regulator. So what's happening now is most of the FSB, they are not market conduct regulators. They tended to focus on prudential. So in a sense, all the prudential people in the FSB, if one took this to its logical conclusion, would go to the SOC. So certainly in insurance, that is happening. Okay. A lot of the issues around investment funds and so on tend to be more market conduct than perhaps prudential. So, you know, we're not going to move everyone to the SOC and have pure prudential and pure market conduct. So even with pensions, there's a prudential element. And the SOC might have a handful of people and they should be looking at it. But most of your prudential regulation is of a market conduct nature, will be done by the market conduct regulator, certainly at the start. So if you look at the bill, at some point, and these are transition issues, we're not going to move to pure prudential and pure market conduct. That's literally impossible anyway. But it will be phased in. But the prudential authority is the one that will set prudential standards for everyone. And the market conduct authority will do that for everyone. If you go to the UK, for example, the Bank of England does prudential oversight for banks, insurance, and anyone else seem to be as systemically important, an asset manager, some of them. But the FCA, the market conduct, does market conduct and does low-risk prudential for everybody else. Okay. So that just becomes a practical way of how to operate. And we don't want to say to the regulators how they should operate. They need to have a sensible balance, taking into account costs for the industry. But they need to have a risk-based approach. So the risk here certainly need to be dealt with the primary regulators. So, and of course, the other thing is, the old way of doing it was to call something banking or deposit taking, long-term insurance, short-term insurance. So there are financial products that don't fit into any definition and they don't get regulated. So for that reason, and Kathy can and Roy can talk more about it, is financial products, financial services are also defined. But like Roy had said, underlying a pension, there'll be an insurance element. You won't know it as the member. Okay. So you can't really, even in the FSV, that's the problem. There's a deputy register of retirement funds and there's a deputy register for long and short term insurance. Do they really talk to each other? I don't know. I'm just raising the question, okay? And by the way, if you're a regulator and you look at regulators, you must be completely skeptical and ask them the obvious questions, because the chances are they don't do the obvious, which is talk to each other, okay? Or make sure they don't operate in silos. So, just broadly, and I'm going to ask Roy and Kathy to come in. Let me just deal with the issue we are creating and actually expanding on regulation with market conduct. That is a new area. It's not been done generally for all financial products. So the National Credit Regulator is probably more of a market conduct regulator, but only focuses on credit. Okay? It's now, in a sense, covering everything else. That's what we're doing. So the changes are quite deep, and the chair asked, what does the banking sector or the financial sector think about it? Roy and Kathy can come with the major objections. I don't think that, obviously, I think that people know that the world is changing, and there's no opposition to regulation on the one hand, because many of them operate in the UK, and they face the Twin Peaks system there. So they, in a sense, understand the direction internationally. I think their concerns are more micro. They may have issues about the number of regulators and are we rationalizing it? Can we be more efficient? Yes, the levies will. Remember, currently, as you pointed out, that, there is a levy that people are paying, or cost that they're paying. Whether the final cost will be more than that is difficult to say, but also given that we're expanding, the cost will increase. And really, the approach on costing is, once the system is there, because in a way, it's not like you start with what does it cost and then decide how much regulation you want, which is perhaps the normal way of doing something. This is a case where you've got to do these things, whether you like it or not. It's become necessary for the financial sector. If we didn't do any of this, our financial institutions will beg us to regulate them and supervise them because they have consequences outside our borders. So it's a question of, let's take Basel III. Yes, it's more costly. It's even more costly for the banks because they have to have higher capital buffers. And if you're the SIFI, it has consequences for the company. It means it needs to put even more capital aside, okay? Which means that it's going to be less profitable end for end, perhaps, with a non-SIFI, okay? So the costs are big issues. But Roy, do you want to comment on the costs?
I think the cost question is very important, and they're all linked quite closely together. The key comments from the data advisors were specifically on the constitutional implications of how do we go about levying for these institutions. I was going to say that later, but there is actually going to have to be an additional bill which fits with this bill, which will be a money bill for the actual levy raising of the amount will be allocated to the institutions through the levy process.
The important thing with how you impose a levy is it should be a transparent process. Because the one thing you see, even when you ask, what will banks say? My worry is when they come to Parliament, they'll say there's nothing wrong. The regulators are afraid to make any negative statements against any regulator. They'll say to you in private, okay, so talk to them privately, I think that's fine. Because they're afraid, because it shouldn't be that when they criticize a regulator, when they get punished by a vindictive regulator. Okay, it shouldn't be, but it happens. Okay, I've seen regulators who go out to the press and say, you know, I'm closing it down because you criticized me. That's unacceptable, okay? A regulator is not God, and similarly, it's expected to be God, but it's not God, right? And in the sense that when they fail, people will say, why didn't you see it, okay? That's why you will have bank failures. But to the extent that they can be held to account, what I was saying with any failures, it's important to for them to be asking hard questions. Could we have done it better? What didn't we get right? And when they make mistakes, that they are in some way accountable to Parliament. It's very hard for that to be done anywhere because the regulators can bury their mistakes. They're like doctors. You never know you really got it wrong. You just know that there's a body afterwards, but they can do 50 reasons why that person died or something happened. It's very difficult, but something that we need to think about. Right, sorry.
And then the system of termination of the levy will be contained in that bill in quite a lot of detail. There won't be any surprises. The system of determination of levy payable to this authority will be very similar to the current system of how levies are raised by the SSB. And so we expect in the first year or two that there will not be much financial implication. But as we go through the additional new piece of legislation over the course of the next 3 years, we will have to make amendments to that money bill. So you will see each time, and it will be a very clear process that we will have to follow on that. I think we are definitely bringing more transparency to the funding framework of the regulators.
I have my doubts anyone in the FSB gets paid 5 times more than an MP. Maybe twice, but they will bring their annual report, so you'll be able to see what the salary is tracking.
Yeah. I know they get more than that. Then, so the very difference between the South African system and the British system is that in South Africa, driver hour rate is calculated by the JSE, which is, in some extent, has regulatory requirements under the Financial Markets Act. It's really calculated by a regulator to some extent, whereas in the UK it was calculated by the Banking Association. So that's probably why, to some extent, our process was, the integrity of our process was essentially better. When we get to the bill, we'll explain how the process will be that benchmarks will be included as regulated types of things, as I highlighted there. So I think the system will, to some extent, prevent abuses, market manipulation abuses like that.
Yeah, the LIBOR example is an interesting one, even the South African context, if it's not as dangerous, you could say, because what it does is illustrate and goes to the question of how we shift things. At the moment, what we've got is a world where, in our law, it would say, JIBAR and you need to consider how JIBAR is calculated. That's the approach to regulating supervision today. Going forward, it shifts that. So in other words, currently, if not named, if JIBAR is not already in the law, no one's going to be looking at it. So it can slip between the cracks. Going forward, the objectives of the authorities are different. It's not about looking at JIBAR. It's about scanning for risks. And depending on which regulator you're talking to, it looks at that respective risk, stability, prudential, conduct. So what that means is going forward, the conduct authority should be looking and saying, where do we see risks coming up? Is LIBOR JIBAR in our scenario, is that relevant to us? What are the impacts of JIBAR on the broader economy, on integrity of the system? And if they see a risk, then they need to take steps to respond to that risk. So there's two questions there. One is, do that jurisdiction, and if they've got jurisdiction, how are they going to be looking to take preemptive regulatory interventions before problems happen? And that's really the major, the question around what is the difference between today and we've introduced toolkit. It really goes to the heart of changing the supervisory approach.
Yeah.
But I think the question on being cost-effective, sorry, so moving away from Bible and Java, is an important one and needs to be looked at all the time. It gets to the accountability issue as well. And you hope that even in the process of securing their budget, this issue does come up. And by the way, it's where we then also differ with probably standards and Basel intruders and out, because there's a view among regulators, and that's because they write those standards for themselves also, that independence means that they get their own budget, effectively doesn't go through Parliament. They can do what they like, pay themselves what they like. We said, this is a democracy. Other countries also break that regulatory standard. There needs to be accountability. So there are some issues that may differ with international standards, but certainly I think that, whatever we mean by accountability. Roy, just the point of what are the issues that the state law advises that they, you see, it's quite difficult to say what, in a sense, because they've all obviously looked at old versions, but part of the thing here has been, and it comes to the issues of the Banks Amendment Act, which I think really missed an exciting session and seen how even one institution could come with three different opinions, okay? Because everyone's got different fiduciary responsibilities. And everybody, of course, would raise constitutional issues, because part of it is you do need to have some pretty far-reaching powers. And often the constitutional opinion was, well, you can have the clause, but once you exercise it, how you're doing it will also have constitutional implications. So what?
No, the issue constitutionally, there were quite a few draft suggestions, which we've included almost all of them, was on the levies bill, and to what extent levies must be done separately from the main bill, which we assess and have. So the bill has shrunk a little bit, but there will be an additional bill to go with it.
Why then? It's a money bill, so I don't know why he needed it. He doesn't.
Chair, just, I can see that we have obviously drawn some lessons from Apple's failure, but I'm still not sure whether we are paying sufficient attention on asset managers. And that's because asset managers, by virtue of being asset managers, they're not like the direct people that you deal with, you know, the pension fund, who is looking at the pension fund. But the people that ultimately take the decision, of course there are trustees and what have you, but ultimately the people that decide in which assets they should be investing in. It's largely your asset managers. And I'm not sure where do they fall in this whole scheme of things. Are we going to be focusing on them, or are we going to be leaving them out and hoping that the trustees, and you must remember something, trustees are often not necessarily financial people, and they are there by virtue of being entrusted by other members to actually sit there. But the people that really are supposed to be exercising some kind of, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I'm just feeling that I don't know whether we are paying attention on asset managers. Because if we look at what we went through with Apple, the people that are actually giving us pennies, it wasn't up the pension funds. The pension funds were, when all they were expecting was the return on their money. But it was the asset managers that were like, on our case saying, no, this can't be done this way, or whatever, you know what I mean? So I'm saying, where do they fall in this scheme of things? Can somebody assist me there?
Basically, remember, so whether it's asset managers, whether it's reinsurance, whether it's, there's another, they are all dealt with by the two regulators. But bear in mind, one is prudential and the one is market conduct. Now the issues you raise probably would be market conduct, but you know, the question to raise on pension funds is music to my ears, because when we look at retirement funds, the point is, what's the point of having trustees who don't understand what they're doing and are totally dependent on asset managers, okay? Then there's a problem. Would I want my pension fund to have such trustees? I'm not so sure, okay? So if they're not doing their job, how do you get the system to ensure that the trustees actually do their jobs? And it's, when I've said that we want to have a session on retirement reform, I think that's why these are all the kinds of questions, because there is a, the trustees who represent workers do bring an important element, okay? But, and I'm convinced that that opinion needs to be there, but why should people give a blank check to asset managers? You see, from a prudential side, asset managers may decide where to invest, but these are custodial services. So the funds are safe in a sense that when members want it, I guess they have it. There may or may not be market conduct issues, and yes, that's where we want the focus to be. Whether they're investing on an infrastructure long-term, you know, the trustees can play a role there, and they should be playing a role. So in the treasury, we considered actually, and by the way, that's why we don't, I personally and many of our staff, we don't attend any of these retirement conferences. You know why? Because the people who convene them are asset managers. And you say, but you guys are not trustees. You go there, you see stalls of companies, okay? So, and people get tempted to go to these dorms, they get, you know, asset managers, put them up in hotels. I've seen our friends in the unions, their conferences in Mahalisburg, and I say, who pays for this? They'll have the company. I say, this is a disgrace. This is your money they're using. Why you have them here? My fight with the regulators is, why haven't you got the governance regulations in place? We've been pushing the regulator to do it because, and we're frustrated because we're saying that I want you to, every company to disclose every cent they spend for conferences and they feel, you know, to spend towards trustees, because I think there's a lot of very cozy and relationships there. We need to shine a light and we need to stop those practices. Okay. But let's talk to it when it comes to retirement reform, because you'll see there are very different interests that prevent this, and government will really have to lead on these issues, and nobody will like us for it, because we'll be stopping lots of, I think, disgraceful practices that take place. So yes, they will be covered, and yes, they'll be covered by both, but there are other issues of financial inclusion, of financial integrity that also come in, and also the role that funds play in investing for the long term, especially given that these are pension funds. I don't know if there's any other questions. The costs also, sorry, would fall in, so that's why we're not mentioning them specifically. They would all fall in under these regulators. We're not excluding anybody. That's not our approach.
The last question on your question about the major issues that came up in consultation, the levies came up quite a lot, coordination came up quite a lot, the original draft of the bill on financial conglomerates, that came up quite a lot. Both of those comments have been taken into account, so that's, and standards and empowers, we would say that in a moment. Standards and empowers is the way in which we create regulation, but we would say that. That is a wonderful moment for us to upward to delegate to the committee.
What?
Delegate that to the committee, upward delegation.
I think the point is, yes, you do need to find a way of accountability on the one hand to the executive, on the other hand to Parliament. And look, there are measures that you can look at. For example, if a regulator, if the ombuds is getting too many complaints, it probably means the regulator's not done his or her work. In the sense that if there's too many complaints of a certain type, sure, there needs a feedback mechanism from the ombud to the regulator. Because you only go to the ombud if it's a market conduct problem. You know, because it's not been sorted out by the internal complaints mechanisms of the company. I think we found practices where our regulators just look the other way. And they need to look at the feedback mechanisms, they need to step up their accountability, their analytical expertise. And of course you need quiet conversations with people. So the industry may not say it loudly, but when there are privacies, I think that you'll find that people do talk. they won't come here and say, that's what I find disappointing. I don't know what they're so scared of. Because I think, because a regulator is vindictive, they should be fired and actually put in jail. Because you should never be vindictive. You're in a position of responsibility, and you should never ever have a situation where regulators act vindictively and can't take criticism here.
This is a request. I was just thinking that maybe it might be useful for National Treasury to just give us a broad, even if it's going to be like a one-pager, a broad set of principles that govern the prudential aspect and one that governs the market conduct aspect. I think that's going to assist us to understand exactly where is what located. I'm talking for other members as well. I don't think it's something that you can respond to. I'm just making a request. Because it's going to assist us. Because in any case, they're going to be overlap, but at least let's have those broad principles in the separate, in these two aspects.
Okay,
great.
Move on to the next section.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. I just want to confirm that in respect of the bill being referred back by the state law advisors, then are you confirming the only constitutional issue was a constitutional issue in respect of the levies?
At the moment, we're not getting a formal... there's a lot of discussion that takes place. And like Kathy was saying, she'll come in. Let's say putting in standards. You see, the issue, and look, this gets to the heart of democracy as well. You can take a view that all legislation must be done through Parliament, okay? But if you want to see the Basel III regs, you'll be thankful that it hasn't come here, okay? Yet, how do we deal with it? Do we have a transparent process? So it gets to your what's called your sub-regulations and subordinate regulations and so on. Regulators actually have the power of law, but it's perhaps law with a small L. Directives, etc. We are rationalizing those things. Now, how you issue those, and those issues came up with the Banks Amendment Act as well, for example. So there's always issues like those that do come in, because you are giving them pretty draconian powers, okay? But that's the way the world has gone. It's not out of line, okay? Yes, it has to be constitutional. And the most we can do is to make sure that the process for them have standards. Because I would guess that there are times the regulators just issue a decree and they've not really followed a process that's similar to legislation where they take comment. And when we talk of accountability, I think the role of the department is to see every time they issue it, have they heard those who have issued comments? Have they made any changes? Because it could be just an exercise of form rather than substance. Those are areas that we need to look at, but don't come in here.
Just to clarify, it's not a case of we send a bill to state advisors for certification.
Let me just clarify what I'm driving at. Has the state law advisor raised issues of constitutionality? And I understand that they're comments at this stage. If the state law advisor has raised issues of constitutionality, what are they?
I think we're clarified. Well, they haven't raised any issues of constitutionality. They've provided drafting comments. We've engaged with them on their advice about how we should deal with levies. And they've actually taken our advice, because the Treasury is very conservative on levies. They haven't raised any constitutional issues. They are not. They will then certify the bill. And they can only certify the bill if they think it's constitutional. So it's actually impossible for them to raise constitutional issues with the project. And then you've also got your team. We've been through many bills and we've had lots of advice. Your parliamentary advisor will give constitutional advice. And so we will see, there will be one or two issues which we will have taken constitutional advice on, which will come up, but that will come up in the process.
So are there constitutional issues, and if there are, what are they?
I don't understand what you're saying.
If they know.
And in any case, they can't certify as well.
No.
Unless they think it's constitutional. If indeed later down the road, between now and the 7th of September, they find something that they feel is unconstitutional, go lawyers and say, well, hey, just sort the matter out. And we have Frank Chicken sitting right here. So I think the question has been adequately answered, actually. Can we move over to the next session, please?
None that we are aware of. Okay, so Chair, now let's get to the bill itself, okay, and what it does. I'm tired of this. You need to know it. Okay, but
actually, it's quite an outside in terms of...
So, Chair, the most important chapter is the one that Roy doesn't have here, which is chapter 1. Because it causes definitions. It takes pages. Okay. And
so
certainly...
Which helps the presentation, this part of the presentation. We haven't looked at the whole bill.
We want to give you the final bill when you get it right. So, Chair, and Kathy will go through some of the issues on financial products, financial services, and certainly when we go through the bill, we'll point out some of what we consider the key definitions, what's market infrastructure, what's this, that, etc., which you have to take into account when you read the book. Who's a financial services regulator and who's not? Okay. All of those impact on the bill in a major way. So firstly, those definitions, and but we'll come to those, right?
Yeah.
Then you get to chapter 2. Let me just talk to chapter 2, which focuses firstly on macro financial stability and the role of the staff, okay, in that. Now, you may mind that the Minister of Finance in 2010, Roy, Minister Gordon's first budget, or MCPPS, delegated the job of overseeing financial stability to the governor. Now, as in all things, in some countries, these are done jointly by the governor and the equivalent of the Minister of Finance. But I think most still give the power to the governor. The minister will certainly be setting the framework on financial stability with the governor. But the point is that we don't want the governor ever to say there's a problem because he couldn't find the minister. Okay? And certainly if you're going to ask the minister needs to consider it. It can take time. Okay? We are a bureaucracy. There's a way in which bureaucracies work. The staff is meant not to be a bureaucracy. And it's meant to be able to act with speed. And so this is a global issue. Of course, there's many issues that it's not a simple clear line. It's when and how does the governor then consult with the exec. There are times when, for example, the governor has to consult with the minister. Certainly, if you look at when they're declaring a dictatorship currently, because it may involve some call on the fiscus. Then they've got to get the approval of the Minister of Finance. There are other times when perhaps it should just be an after consultation. Okay. But anything they do, you could touch on the health minister if it's something to do with medical schemes and they're taking action against a financial group that has a medical scheme there. How do you deal with it? So then we find that we have to read the laws in other acts. Or if the Competitions Commission takes up a case, that sits with the Minister of Economic Development. We talked about CGI. So there's a whole lot of typical issues that we've had to deal with, but our judgment call has been that the governor should be responsible for overseeing financial stability within a framework determined with the minister. The governor also designates SIFIs in order to, and as we said, these are systemically important financial institutions. And bear in mind, like in the US, the Fed has declared certain insurance companies SIFIs and they are resisting it. And they resist it because although on the one hand there's moral hazard in the system in that a major bank knows if it fails, government will be forced to intervene. Okay, that's what happened. And in fact, probably should have happened in 2008, that Lehman should have been saved in retrospect. But once you're a SIFI, you have to put up more capital. You're going to get more intrusive supervision, okay? So it does increase your costs tremendously, okay? There's also, and it's not just banking and insurance or perhaps an asset management groups, but your market infrastructure, your payment infrastructure. Now, we define market infrastructure and payment services as per the NPS Act definition, right? Yeah. But I mean, so that includes the in market, no, line of payments is different. I'm saying market infrastructure, like the JSEs, trade, all of those are covered there, okay. And I should add that there are organizations that don't belong in the public sector that you may never have heard of. Let's take BankServe. It's market infrastructure. It's owned by the private banks. If that were to fall or something happens, there could be a crisis as well. So the governor will have the power to decree through a proper process what the fee is. And just to make the point we made earlier, so when you read the Act, there are times when you should see it as a sub where the governor is in charge, given the operation of monetary policy, lender of last resort, etc. But there are times when they act as a prudential regulator, as a payment system regulator, as, you know, we've talked about exchange control. And even though the legislation will say SARB, but we will try and point out this is in a capacity as if they were regulators. So if they were in Australia, we would just say the prudential authority. We wouldn't say it's a SARB. So you do need to differentiate the use of the word SARB to make matters really difficult for you.
So we're going to be talking through each of the new authorities, the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority. And this goes to the earlier questions around how is this going to be different from what we have now. And partly it's about the objectives, redefining the objective of these institutions. Partly it is about developing trying to develop the best breed of supervisory toolkit response mechanism. And partly it's also about a much clearer sense of jurisdiction and scope and who's responsible for what. So if we look at the Prudential Authority, it's responsible, as we've been talking about earlier, the safety and soundness of financial institutions. Now this is an important distinction from where we are now, which is a registrar being responsible for a bank, or a registrar being responsible for an insurer and the like. Now we're responsible for the safety and soundness of financial institutions, and what that means in practice is if you combine this with the increasing move towards a risk-based approach to supervision, it's increasingly focusing the authority's attention on those institutions which are considered to be bringing the most risk to the system. The focus here you will see is very much on the balance sheet of the institution, as opposed to conduct, where the focus is on the relationship between the institution and its customer and how that happens. There are a couple of very important concepts to understand when you're talking about the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority that really anchor the role. And one is around financial product, and one is around financial service, and one is around financial institution. A financial institution, in effect, is any institution which will be providing a financial product or financial service. And what we're trying to capture is if you are doing financial activity as a business, you become a financial institution. That's the principle. So it starts getting around the question of if you are lying out, you're providing a type of insurance product, but you are not strictly fitting within the definition of the long-term or the short-term insurance act, therefore you're outside our law. We're moving away from that. And that's increasingly important in a world where who's offering the financial product, what that product looks like, how it's distributed, for example, remittances through cell phone technology, those lines have become increasingly blurred. So going back in, the Prudential Authority in effect is responsible for overseeing financial institutions that provide financial products. A product is a thing. It's your participating interest in a collective investment scheme. It's an insurance policy. It's a deposit. It's the actual thing that is connecting the customer with what it is they're trying to derive from the financial activity. So right up front, we spoke about what does the sector do? It facilitates borrowing, facilitates saving, risk mitigation. Those things happen through a product. So the Prudential Authority is responsible for financial safety and soundness of financial institutions that provide financial products. That is the precursor. The flip side will be to then looking at the conduct supervisor and what it's responsible for, but it needs to be seen within the context of financial institutions providing financial products. So what does it look like, this thing we call a prudential authority? And just to highlight, you will see that there are there's a distinct difference in the structure, the proposed structure between the prudential authority and the conduct authority. And that is inherently because of the decision to house the prudential authority within the Reserve Bank. And in short, that was determined on the basis, yes, you want a prudential authority that is a separate juristic person, that is independent and can operate independently from the Reserve Bank, but at the same time, because of the close synergy necessary between macro-prudential and micro-prudential supervision and the maintaining of stability, it was made the decision and that's not the discussion has been around housing prudential authority within the South African Reserve Bank. So in effect, what that means is, and if you're looking at that triangle, you'll see that there's what's provided in law, the statutory component is the triangle. And what we provided for is a head of the prudential authority, the CEO. The CEO, in effect, would be a deputy governor within the, elected within the South African Reserve Bank structure. The CEO is responsible for operational day-to-day decision-making of the Prudential Authority. But in order to ensure strategic guidance and oversight and alignment with the South African Reserve Bank, we've provided for an oversight committee, which is made up of the governor and the other deputy governors to ensure the cohesion. And what we're trying to achieve here is the balance between alignment within the Reserve Bank and its statutory obligations and stability function, and independent operating of the prudential authority and in terms of achieving its mandate. What's also provided for are our governance committee, and this is the same, there'll be a similar mirror happening between prudential authority and the conduct authority, where the governance committees are basically your REFCO responsible for remuneration and the like. So they're purely governance. They'll have no strategic or board function in one general understanding of the board.
So, Chair, for the purpose of quickly, just if you look at the table of contents you've handed out, so we'll get to clause by clause, go into a little more detail, but you can see that part two on page four of the table of contents sets out all the clauses that deal with what Cathy's just spoken about. You know, the governance objective, the CEO's appointment, the role, the term of office, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of the thickness of all comes about because you actually have to specify when you're getting an institution, you have to kind of go to all the details. So when we get to go into the bill in more detail, then you'll see exactly what we would now for each of these components.
Can I say that the 2NC effectively really has a far-reaching effect on the functioning of the staff. So over and above what they do, it will probably change their... It's forcing change, which by the way they're beginning to implement already, on their structure, which is very significant. That's why we made sure that we had a joint committee to work with the staff and the FSB, because firstly they are getting a number of people from the FSB who come over. There's hardly anyone from the staff who go over to the new market conduct regulator, I would imagine, because they don't do market conduct. Is there anyone they're even thinking of? And then you've got one deputy governor then who will be responsible for, and the CEO of the Prudential Authority, and another deputy governor who will be responsible for financial stability. And of course the governor is overall responsible for financial stability as well. But that's how they're going to be dividing some of their responsibilities in the South.
None of the movements that they have started taking their PhD.
For the staff, they don't need a change in law. They do financial stability currently, so nothing stops them from saying deputy governor so-and-so is responsible for this, and another deputy governor is responsible for the bank's provision department and so on. So to some extent, they've already been doing this because since 2011, this was the direction they as a central bank had to go, so they're doing that in some sense. They're having discussions with the FSB, but yet there's no actual movement of people in the sense that the responsibilities there in the FSB Act and their legislation will reside in FSB. So those things they can't do. But on financial stability, remember they also produce a financial stability review half and what? Twice a year. So they've been doing this even before 2011.
Have had sort of shadow systems really moving, so they've kind of, particularly on insurance, because that's the big team that will move across, there's been a lot of shadow provincial authority work going on, and the bank has really actually been a little bit, they're very organized, they've really made space for the building, and the computers and the desks have been allocated, and so.
So just two further elements just to highlight is that from where we are today to where we're moving in terms of the structure is we have a situation at the moment where, for example, the registrar banks, there is an indistinct line of responsibility and accountability between his responsibility or accountability to the minister on the one hand versus the governor being a part of the reserve bank structure on the other. And I'm just using this illustratively, but you can find these types of examples across our law currently. So what we pay very careful attention to in the proposed structure, both the prudential authority and the conduct authority, even though that is slightly differently, is making sure we are very clear on who's responsible for what, when, and how that line of accountability happens. So in this instance, we've got a CEO overseeing the oversight committee headed by the governor, and when we get into the essence of the bill, we'll see how that relationship and decision-making lines up much more clearly with the role of the minister. Hopefully, it improves over to this world. Also, just to highlight on what you see is below the triangle of what's defined as that management organizational structure. That's not contained in the bill. What it's in effect is providing for is how the new organization to be structured, different from how it is today. And what Roy was talking about a moment around how we've really started moving in that direction, those types of changes are already happening. So, for example, currently we have one unit will focus on banks, one unit which isn't currently in the Reserve Bank, one unit focuses on insurance and FSB. We are moving towards a world where looking towards one unit looking at the financial groups and what for the prudential oversight of those groups, which would include banks, would include insurance, then there would be a potentially a market infrastructure unit, and so on and so forth. So already that conversation and the dialogue about how best to organize the actual supervisory structure of the organization is happening. So looking in at the conduct authority, the Conduct Authority is responsible for the fair treatment of financial customers, market integrity, and education, consumer education. Again, just to highlight the focus on VA, it's around that outcome. How are customers treated? So that's different from today's world, which says FSB, you need to have a requirement around disclosure. Yes, disclosure is likely one element around how customers are treated, but in that disclosure, are those rules, are those requirements actually delivering a better outcome for customers? Currently, the law is not structured, it's not orientated in that way. The new law, it is, and we're moving in that direction. So looking at the definition, we spoke about a financial product being the thing, being the insurance policy, being the deposit. The conduct authority is responsible of services provided in relation to those products. So how are those products designed, how are they sold, how are they distributed, how are they marketed, how can complaints be made around those products? Those general principles, which ultimately are intended to support a better customer focus, that's the responsibility of conduct authority, and that's how the financial service is defined in relation to that. So just you can see here the proposed definition being offering, promoting, marketing or distributing, providing advice, dealing or making a marketing, operating or managing, providing administration services. Importantly, financial services extend beyond what I just described. So MoMA has raised the question around payment services. Currently what we do, we have a payment act, a payment system act, which is very focused on the infrastructure, how payments happen, the mechanism of how payments happen. But it doesn't silence on conduct issues within that. So we've introduced a new definition for payment service to make sure that these types of services are brought within the scope. Important for both product and service definition. Yes, what we have, what we're proposing, is a clear definition which applies a limit on these products. Financial products are these things, financial services are these things, but what happens about these things slightly outside of that? And we've provided for a designation clause. And how the designation clause works is that if something has the flavor of being an investment, or insurance, or deposit taking, or any one of the activities that we'd be describing about, if it has those characteristics, but for some reason falls outside of how this has been defined, it can be named as such. It can be named as a financial product or a financial service. And in effect, being brought within the scope of the authority of the law and implies that it would need to be licensed and authorized, and the implication of that being we can set standards or regulatory requirements on it.
Just to give an example, Honorable Ross kept on raising the issue of property syndication, for example. So, you know, those are the kinds of gaps that are there. And currently, unless you then legislate for it, it's not regulated.
So what we're trying to do is bring a balance between, to some extent, having a clear outline of the scope of the law by having the list of what is the product and what is the service, but at the same time, recognizing the constant transitional and changing nature of the sector, trying to have flexibility to be able to bring things within the ambit of the law when it's behaving like a financial product or service, but for whatever reason, carrying to myself outside. So the conduct authority is structured differently from the prudential authority, and the main difference being because it's a standalone institution. It is not sitting within the South African Reserve Bank. So what that means is the entire governance, the strategic governance, the oversight has to fit within the standalone institution. So in order to support stronger decision making and stronger accountability, it's been proposed as a commission structure made up of a commissioner being the head of the organization, supported by the Deputy Commissioner. And importantly, there are certain roles and responsibilities afforded to the authority which cannot be delegated downwards. The types of things I'm talking about would be licensing of institutions, subordinate regulation making powers, determining the regulatory strategy, and we'll talk more about what that regulatory strategy is. These are key functions, key decision-making functions of the organization, which we think are so important that they need to be made by this most senior body. Also supported by the governance committee, you'll see doesn't have a board structure. Those governance committees, the same as with the prudential authority, risk remuneration audit. Separating out if you then to look between the statutory, what's contained within the law, the prudential law, and what would lie without or outside of the law, the authority itself, how that is defined, is within the Twin Peaks law. outside of that and how the management is going to be orientated, well, that's for the organization to work out for itself. One more crucial difference, just to highlight, between how powers vet now versus how they're going to be vetting in this arrangement, both for the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority. Currently, powers vet in a registrar, one person. In this new environment, in the 20th world, powers vet in the authority. They vet in the Prudential Authority and they vet in the Conduct Authority. And that is an important distinction, again, one because of who's responsible, but also in terms of how those powers and the exercise land up being defined slightly differently. We vested them into the authority rather than a registrar, again, to improve transparency in decision-making, improve part of the governance strengthening, or the proposed strengthening governance arrangements and types. I'm not going to go into that in too much detail now because we do speak specifically to that.
Which is about half an hour. About 15 minutes or so, 20 minutes maximum. Remember, this is our initial point. When we go through the bill, we will engage more rigorously and vigorously. Just give us a feel for the issues.
So the question has been raised earlier about governance and accountability, and I think we've had probably the strongest anchor for the bill and how much of the interrogation in the earlier stages was around how to build very strong institutions and authorities. And so we've decked itself in different ways, parties around transparency in decision making and transparency even more generally. Transparency and then decision making can be seen separately. So we've considered things, for example, like a regulatory strategy. That the authority needs to be thinking upfront and making public, this is what our area of focus is going to be over a 2-3-5 year period. Engage on it to help in, provide an inclusive consultation way of directing the industry and the system at large as the direction that we're going. Also considering in terms of decision-making, administrative action procedures, making sure that the process is on right, how decision-making happens in the first place, let's try and get that right. Supporting by strong internal remedies for financial institutions or customers, as well as external remedies. There's been a very strong focus on cooperation and collaboration for all the reasons that we've been describing around how institutions function. It's one thing to be saying, well, the Conduct Authority has got this new type of mandate, new type of responsibilities, is that enough? The answer is no, of course it's not enough. We need to be changing the way in which these organizations function. Changing the culture. We're talking about changing culture. We've spoken a lot, particularly on the Conduct side, about changing the culture of financial institutions. This process is much about changing the culture of the regulators and the authorities. Part of that culture is around how decision-making happens, part of it's also around working together in a collaborative way. What's highlighted in front of you are some of the mechanisms by which this is proposed to happen. The Financial Sector Regulators Council is an entity by which both our financial regulators and all the regulators who have an impact on the financial system can come and talk through common issues. The Financial Stability Oversight Committee, focusing on stability, bringing together the key core regulators, Financial Authority, Prudential Authority, FAR, the Credit Regulator, Council of Medical Schemes, talking through stability issues, stability matters. The Financial Sector Interministerial Council considered to be dealing with issues of overlap between Treasury and the DTI, and the Financial Sector Contingency Forum, actually still already in play, it deals with when a moment of financial crisis, who has to be involved in managing that crisis. Besides these mandated structures, of course, what's critical are the MOUs, or those ongoing day-to-day relationships between the various, particularly the core regulators, and the bill goes into quite a lot of detail in trying to work out how best the regulators should be managing dealing with each other. So, for example, the setting of standards or regulations, regulatory requirements, making sure that before the Conduct Authority sets regulatory requirements on an entity that's regulated by the Prudential Authority, have a conversation about what those standards are and what the impact of those standards are going to be, to make sure that they are not necessarily going to be compromising. Yes, they might be for conduct, but maybe compromising tradition in some way and getting that standards right. The bill goes through a lot of, or at least it lays the basis for harmonized systems of regulation. We are not getting there on day one. On day one, what we're doing is we're setting up the general authorities, and those authorities with the respective mandates that we've been described. The sectoral laws will in effect stay the same. The law, the insurance, well, the insurance laws will not change, but you know, the Act, the Loss Insurance Act, the Health Investment Schemes Act, and the like, they're still there. But what we're now going to have is an overlay, a common overlay, so that we can start moving towards common system of licensing, a common approach to making subordinate regulation, coordinated supervision, a consolidated way or a harmonized way in how to enforce, how enforcement happens. So what you'll see in the bill, and what you'll get a very clear flavor of, is yes, all these laws are still in play, but what we've got and what we're moving towards is making sure that our authorities have got the best toolkit in order to start harmonizing where appropriate across the system.
I think that this is really the big cost saver, and to the extent you can get more uniformity and harmonization in just the way things are done. So just to give you an example, currently, and I don't want to pick on the NCR, let me pick on the FIC. If the FIC, if there are site inspections on the anti money laundering systems, you know, the bank supervisor may go on one day, the financial, in FSB, each registrar will go on different days. We said to them, to the extent that you can go and do the entire group and have, you know, one way of doing these things, can it be achieved on its own feet? That's the challenge that we're facing. So we would want to bring in, for example, the FIC as well, because it's very cross-cutting, to have similar inspection systems, similar powers, similar to the extent that it's possible. So we say to them, argue against us having similar powers. If it doesn't make sense for money laundering, then argue your case. But otherwise, we want to almost assume that the enforcement systems, etc., are all similar. The way people would appeal against a regulator, that there are similar issues that come up, or similar systems that operate.
Answers the earlier question, which was quite a question about trying to identify what is prudence and what is conduct. You know, what is the things that are in the grain of the prudential authority and what are the things in the conduct authority, not just sort of high-level things, but real practical examples. So here we've set out what they are. So prudential, that is like saying what standards are relevant to it. Prudential things are like liquidity. How much liquidity does your organization have? How much leverage do you allow a bank to take on? What are the risk management systems that the bank has internally? How much capital does it hold? So those are the sort of things which we would regard put under the kind of a prudence or prudential matter issue. So, for example, leverage in this case means how much the a bank is allowed to borrow. So the Basel III requirements set out quite detailed. It's chapters on how much, what types of things a bank is allowed to borrow against, what sort of the overall amount of borrowing that it can have, etc., etc., etc. Risk management, there are chapters on it in the Basel requirements around sort of systems the bank must have internally to ensure that if there are operational products, that it doesn't fall over. Then on the conduct side, the things are more like product design, product design, advice, what is disclosed to the customer and how transparent the system is.
When you're talking product design, we're not saying to be prescriptive financial institution or product that look like this. It's more around making sure that the specific products are, the process by which products are designed could happen in a certain way to make sure that there are customer interests or benefits in mind. But also around making sure that commensurate standards, so in other words, disclosure or advice requirements the more complicated the product, the more onerous the related type requirements are intended to be or could be. So we just need to be cautious about understanding.
So one of the big things that this bill does, and it is quite a big step forward, is it provides for the ability of the two authorities to set standards on these two matters. So currently, under the Banks Act, these liquidity leverage risk management capital requirements are set through regulations, and there is a procedure that they go about, and they run about 1,100 pages of regulations. What we are proposing to do is to migrate the system to saying that for certain types of matters, and we have a very extensive list, and we explain very carefully in the bill what the matters are, we are saying that these are within the ambit of the two authorities. And this follows the process we had put in place in previous legislation, so in the Financial and Service General Amendment Bill, which obviously became an act. There was a lot of engagement between the Treasury and the Committee on exactly how you go about defining when can a regulatory authority set standards rather than them being through regulation. So we have put out a very clearly defined public consultation process in the law and also put in place systems to ensure that the two authorities control each other and that they, for example, in the case of syndicated board financial institutions, that the Prudential Authority imposed them, but that the Reserve Bank may ask the Prudential Authority to do so. So there might be quite a lot of discussion actually on this point in the public hearing, because it is quite a new thing. It's quite standard in terms of what other countries do. On licensing, Chapter 8 in the bill, we don't change existing licensing requirements. It came up quite a lot in public consultations at the very first draft of the bill. We just assumed that the industry would realize that we hadn't said you could have your license for everything, but we hadn't actually said it in the law, and so there was a bit of uncertainty. We have now made it very clear that if you have a license under the Banks Act, there's no change. And in actual fact, if you want to be a new bank, you apply under the Banks Act, et cetera, et cetera. But as Cathy highlighted, and that also goes to the question about JIBAR, is that if we decide to designate a product or service, then we can provide them, and the bill does allow for a licensing procedure. So one example was very eye-opening to me with the Credit Rating Services Act. It is a very long piece of legislation. All it does is regulate three credit rating agencies, but because of the way our system works, you have to put very long bills to regulate quite small institutions. So we're hoping to move to a slightly more flexible approach, and then this section basically deals with all the licensing requirements related to that. So just to recap, we have highlighted this before in the presentation, but current licensing requirements remain. So medical schemes are licensed under the Council of Medical Schemes, etc., etc. So I'm not going to go into that. Supervision and enforcement. As you said, we have all these powers already in the Financial Service Board Act and to some extent in the Banks Act and to some extent in the other laws. So basically what we're doing is we're consolidating them in. The most important thing that we're consolidating in is actually the ability to conduct on-site inspections of financial institutions. We have had constitutional court cases on this. The Auction Alliance case in particular has highlighted some proposals. The constitutional court made proposals, they told us to amend the section, which we are doing through this process. So this really does take that forward quite significantly. And then on Ombuds, I'm going to leave it to Kat to talk about the favorite chapter.
Sorry, just one thing before we get on to Ombuds to highlight is that the range of financial sector laws that were highlighted, that there is a responsible authority given the licensing procedures and whatnot, would either be the Prudential or the Constitutional Authority. Although both of the authorities have got jurisdiction over all of these financial institutions. Looking at it on this, we have identified and there's been an ongoing concern around financial customers being confused by the ombudsman. So That is because they are multiple ombuds, and it's also because the ombuds all operate by different standards and requirements. And so what we are proposing is not, and it's also the discussion is being waylaid considerably about whether what's better, the industry ombuds versus the statutory ombuds. So rather than get embroiled in that discussion and everything stalling, what we proposed is to strengthen what is already an ombud council. The ombud council at the moment operates a board arrangement. It's supposed to oversee the ombuds, but it has minimal power and doesn't actually have an office to do that. It doesn't have people to go around doing it. So we're proposing, in effect, a chief ombud. The responsibility of the chief ombud would be not to make decisions about ombud cases, to start implementing a harmonized standard of approach across the ombud system. That's making sure that the ombuds themselves all start operating in a similar or consistent way and at least have a minimum standard. But in addition to which, starting to improve the flow of information between what's happening in the ombud space and what happens with, for example, the conduct authority, making sure that the authority and the ombuds are reciprocating and responding accordingly. I think that there will be a lot of discussion which emerges in terms of what the optimal ombud structure is. And so, I mean, that's going to be an interesting subject going forward as part of the consultations. Also, to highlight one final point, and this is more of a technical element or mechanical element, if we call it that, is that the role of the chief ombud will increasingly be to stand up a single point of entry. So even if we've got multiple ombuds underneath that, making sure that there's a single point of entry and supporting better jurisdictional direction. In other words, we've got a bundle product, the example we've used, supported by credit insurance policy, may have been given advice on the product at some stage. You've got an agreement as a customer, where do you take it? Do you go to the credit ombud? Do you go to the insurance ombud? Do you go to the sales ombud? And we really need greater support for customers in navigating not only which ombud they go to, but starting to think about how these complaints are heard in the first place. Do we need to hear three different complaints for that one product? Can we be thinking of a way that we can actually be combining the resources and hearing the complaint in a more efficient, effective way and an easier to navigate way for the customer?
Okay, we're nearly done, I think. Tribunal, the Financial Services Board Appeal Board is the current mechanism that you can appeal decisions. And then there's also a Board of Review under the BAT Act, and then there's also a appeal mechanism or review mechanism under the FIC Act, and as Ron said, also under the NCR. So we are consolidating everything except for the NCR Tribunal. So we are consolidating the Board of Review, the Financial Services Board Appeal mechanism, and the FIC one into a single one. It'll save a lot of costs. It'll make life a lot easier for everybody. It has a much clearer and more consistent approach to how reviews are done and how decisions are taken on review. It's a very interesting area of the law, which I'm sure there's still a lot of detail on.
This bill does raise a lot of issues, and I said some of it of an architectural nature, but I guess the key point we want to make is we're certainly not saying any one way is the only way, and it's one thing, and two things is a panacea. I think that I've talked about the big conceptual issues, how best to regulate the financial sector. There are also key strategic and policy issues, like apart from the test, the twin peaks will really improve the quality of regulation, given that there are two distinct objectives that we want to focus on. And market conduct is really the big issue. And on market conduct, you see issues like, even if you touch areas like the ombud system and tribunal, I mean, the ombud system is meant to make it easy for customers to get relief in if they feel aggrieved. And the internal complaints processes haven't sorted out their problems. Then, of course, there's organizational issues. What and is coordination going to be enough? I think the FSEP proposals will have to be taken into account. And then there's many, many critical questions that we could raise, like have we gone far enough in dealing with fragmentation, in minimizing the regulatory costs, and of course, have we really reduced the risk of financial instability? That's something, to get back to the nuclear analogy, you don't want whatever happens that the regulators haven't done the work and you have a problem. And Jen, and let me say, if you look at the approach that's taken in the financial sector, in fact, I would add, it actually has regulatory lessons, even for other regulators, whether you're dealing with the nuclear industry, whether you're dealing with aeroplanes and how they fly. I'm sure there's a lot of lessons that one could exchange, and I'm sure we could learn from them as well. In terms of the timelines, Chair, you see the complexity. I think that that's why we're certainly not pushing that the bill be passed before the end of the year. I think that once it's out in the public domain, I do think that you hear things that perhaps we may not have heard. And I think that we should be open to making changes. So, you know, if in a way it can be by early next year, we'd be happy with that. And as I pointed out, that I think if members were to go to a few countries and also do a tour and so on, I mean, if you look at the UK Parliament, I know it's an advanced economy, but if you just speak to the parliamentarians who have been involved in financial regulation, they've been pretty brutal with the regulators and so on. So even from that perspective, I think that there would be a lot to learn. I think lastly, certainly in terms of other departments, and you did ask the question, what's having our discussion? Certainly at the cabinet level, the vote you have is in the form that largely the cabinet has approved. Certainly it doesn't change the provisions to the NCR and so on. That doesn't mean that regulators, and if Roy can tell you about the fight he has just with the FSB and Saab lawyers and so on, because every lawyer has a different opinion. There's lots of opinions that come out, and in fact, that's the issue, is not drowning in millions of comments and different perspectives that you'll see. So there's healthy and robust discussions. We don't agree on everything. This is a way forward, but we have said it's subject to us now just doing the FSAP review quickly in parallel, because we do need to answer the hard questions. So thank you, Jeff.
Members, we've got about 7 minutes, but this is the initial for a bigger theme for the book. Welcome from Bangkok. I know you have to go elsewhere. But over to members. Well, here we are. The answer is yes.
So I don't know if
I think certainly financial inclusion is one of the four key objectives that we have. And certainly, we're working quite hard to bring out the policy paper. There was a lot of work done with the financial sector charter in the early 2000s. But I think that it has also, at some point, been stuck in political disagreements between the constituencies. And my view was that them getting stuck only served the interests of the bad, those propagating bad practices. And I don't believe that some of the targets that are there are in fact tight enough. But you know, the market conduct issues certainly touch on some of the issues that affect financial inclusion, although it's not financial inclusion, because the cost and affordability of products and so on is also a matter of access. And I think when we talk about pension funds and so on, certainly, I mean, there are issues that could come up. So we see that as a separate but parallel process. The same goes for integrity. And, you know, and that's why I'm saying, you know, even there, how does the FIC operate? How much coordination is there? Okay. And if you speak to various people, there are big fights between the institutions. By fights, I mean small. You know, I don't want to exaggerate. There's always, there's a healthy tension in the system. And so the way they do things, other supervisors have their views. And what we in Australia have to do is to play the role of Solomon and kind of make sure that people are following fair processes, they are hearing each other, they are understanding the other's perspective as well. So those issues certainly are issues. And I would say, yeah, get them right up front, but also get the department. Because often I think that when you have different perspectives, it's because there's also a different culture and different approach to things. I think when we did the presentation on market conduct, we indicated how we thought all our regulators were not being effective on market conduct. You know, whether we talked of, if you remember the balloon payments, we talked about the bank regulators and, you know, where there's failure, you've got to ask, were they really, were there things they should have seen earlier? These are hard questions that you need to ask and ensure that people have the right perspective, I think, and understand some of these broader reforms. When we go to some of the regulators and take 2 weeks and try and do the entire system, we find people are just focused on their little area rather than seeing perhaps the bigger picture. But and I think, you know, get them and hear them yourself and see what they say. So we won't agree on everything, there will be differences, and then let's see. You'll see that these issues are not different if you look at other countries where regulators sit. In the UK they hated each other, it seems, almost with a passion that's unbelievable. In Australia it's a different culture, they seem to work very well together. So we are probably somewhere in between with our regulators, and I think this is an attempt to get them all to understand they're regulating the same animals. It doesn't help if they are different. The animal needs to see one face of government and not 5 or 10 different faces. I hope that answers all the questions.
It's about 1 o'clock, so we will continue this process. We'll engage with you offline and for our dates. Tomorrow we meet at 10:30 because the other committee can't make it earlier. So that's that. The ANCMDs have to remain behind on a brief while. The rest of you, can you please keep up for it?
Dissipate even in the case of the DA.